thinks of the fact that he is a black American or a colored American. He can never be unconscious of it in any part of the United States.
Mr. Robeson, have you been back to England since the last war?
Oh, yes, I was back in 49.
The point I wanted to get at is that when I was in England last year, I became aware of the large number of West Indians who are now London, and I heard rather nasty overtones my talks with some Englishmen that frightened me.
No question
about a change that might take place in England.
No, again, if you want to go further into nothing could be worse than South Africa. And I'm only saying, I put these things down. What is most important is that at the height, having lived many years out, and enjoying the height of success in Great Britain, that I decided that I must come back to my own country to struggle in this and to make the sacrifices that I have. That's the most important thing in this regard. And I'm here.
Now wait, would you spell this out again for me? You left England because England is not as attractive, or you feel you have a greater mission in the United States?
No. Let's don't get into that. There are many places in the world where personally it would be much easier to live than in the United States for an American Negro.
In other words, your commitment is definitely to what you feel you can do in this country.
That's right. And Langston Hughes, in a book discussion before the book club in New York just a while ago, pointed out that every important Negro novelist, not only Richard Wright, but many others, that the great 95% of them live in Paris or somewhere else in the world. Mm. Why? Because the pressures personally are much simpler.
And yet, in the foreword of your book that I have before me, you quote Frederick Douglass as saying, "A man is worked on by what he works on."
That's right.
"He may carve out his circumstances, but his circumstances will carve him out as well."
That's right.
Is this part of the reason why you feel that you must be back in the United States?
I made the decision some years ago. I say certainly that I spring essentially from here, like you threw the other day about the Indians in North Carolina. If you recall, that was in Robeson County.
Yes, I noticed that in the item.
Now, this is a very interesting thing which I point out in my book and which explains a good deal, too, of how I feel. Now, I was born on the edge of Robeson County, and my father is a Robeson and was a Robeson because he was a slave, my own father, a slave of the Scottish Robesons who still control Robeson County in North Carolina. Mm-hmm. So I approach these problems from a very close point. But I have a home, and my people are tobacco workers and sharecroppers today on plantations in that county. But a part of that soil belongs to me. That's my roots. These are my roots in this country. On the other hand, also, I felt that somewhere the contributions that I had could make some contribution from my background traveling about the world. However, I never expected, I am quite willing to say, that I would be restricted from traveling.
Yes.
Well, tell me, Mr. Robeson, was your commitment to the political scene then largely as a result of your feeling about your own people, or our own people, let's put it?
Yeah.
Or did it have other overtones of conviction?
First it starts as an American Negro interested in my own people. The other great change is very constant in my mind. I was in the Welsh Valley. And the Welsh people sing very much like we do in the Negro people.
Yes, I've heard
many
them.
Of our songs, beautiful songs. And I was one of the few outsiders who has sung at a Welsh Eisteddfod, their national festival, which has gone on since the time of the Druids. And I went down in the mines with the workers, and they explained to me that, "Paul, you may be successful here in England, but your people suffer like ours. We are poor people, and you belong to us. You don't belong to the bigwigs here in this country." And so I today feel as much at home in the Welsh Valley as I would in my own Negro section, any city in the United States. And I just did a broadcast by translated cable to the Welsh Valley a few weeks ago. And here was the first understanding that the struggle of the Negro people, or of any people, cannot be by itself. That it is a human struggle. And so I was attracted then met many members of the Labour Party, and my politics embraced also the common struggle of all oppressed peoples, including especially the working masses, specifically the laboring people of all the world. And that defines my philosophy. It's a joining one of, we are a working people, a laboring people, the Negro people. And there is a unity between our struggle and those of white workers. In the South, I've had white workers shake my hand and say, "Paul, we're fighting for the same thing." And so this defines my attitude towards socialism and toward many other things in the world. I do not believe that a few people should control the wealth of any land, that it should be a collective ownership in the interest of all.
Is that a democratic socialism, or...?
It would have to be a democratic socialism. There are many ways, however, to struggle toward democracy, as I see that in a place like China, for example, today, the Soviet Union, many other places, or take our own problems of Negroes. If we were free in the South tomorrow to carry our weight, to vote into everything, would we now look around and try to find the 10 billionaires among our people? Would we attempt to build them up, or would we try to answer the needs of the great millions of our people? And so I see other ways of life, socialism, as trying to solve the problems of millions and tens of millions of peoples at once, in a way, instead of we would start from the individual to the masses, they start from the masses this way. Now, there are two ways, and there are difficulties each way. I have made the decision to join in a collective struggle, and the reason that my personal sacrifices mean very little in the struggle. In one way, when you see the children of Little Rock, what does not giving a few concerts mean if you can make some other contribution? It's in that context. So nothing is perfect in the world. We're going toward it from different angles. I feel there's a great burden of proof on every society, on our own as well today.
Mr. Robeson, some years ago, I was talking to a French member of the Communist Party.
Yes.
And in the course of our discussion, he said to me, you, Mr. Winkler, are a Jeffersonian Democrat.
Yes.
You can afford it in your rich land, but in my land and in other lands, we must give up our freedom now to certain men in order to achieve freedom for our children in the future. This is an act of faith for me, he said, giving up my freedom now. Do you find yourself sympathetic with...
I don't think that is... I would put it quite differently. No, nor do I think that's any part of any socialist philosophy or communist philosophy, as far as I know, that we struck it during the war under Roosevelt, for example. We had to give up many privileges. They're practically telling us we have to do that again. I mean, in any sort of a war economy, in England, for example, they have not eaten eggs almost for years and years because of certain pressures. And it seems to me in the socialist lands, the Soviet Union, China, and many places, that that's quite true. It's one thing to say today that they don't have as shining apparel as we do, but they have made tremendous scientific progress. And within one generation, so to speak, within 40 years, have become one of the most powerful countries in the world. Now, they've done it by great sacrifices, and not by, to my mind, they feel that the country, in one sense, the man in the street, may not in every essence belong to him, but he feels it's much more his than, say, I do in Charleston, South Carolina. When one Southern American Negro explained to me that I was in the state of our great plantations, I said, are you sure about that? Our great plantations. I don't feel that they're my plantations. But in one sense, some of the people in socialist lands feel that the country does belong to them in a real sense. Now, and as far as the basic concept of the dictatorship of the proletariat and so forth, I would say, again, bring it back to our own history. There was, as we know, a dictatorship of the North over the South in the days following the Civil War. When that dictatorship was removed, the colored people reverted practically into a kind of servitude. I could have conceived of a dictatorship over the South for quite a longer period, from my point of view, quite frankly. So this is understandable.
Yes. In your book, Mr. Robeson, Here I Stand, you have a chapter entitled The Power of Negro Action.
That's right.
What are some of the specific acts which you recommend, and perhaps in the order of priority?
Yeah. Well, I say in any Negro life, you would say that nobody, this is, seems to be rather startling to many of my friends. Nobody would be startled, say, with taking the vote, the power of Italian action, or Polish action in Detroit, or Catholic action in New York, and so forth. I mean, that the vote would be a block, and the power of the Negro vote in the North in certain states. This is one very important aspect. Very clear. A kind of... we have tremendous economic power in this land today. There should be tremendous support of Negro business, of Negro banks, and so forth, loan associations, and so forth. But the prime thing is that I'm convinced that...
Taking this last illustration of yours, have you not found that as Negro bankers become richer, that they grow away from your people?
No, I don't.
Do they remain a part of total Negro action?
There's no way for, as I said before, for any American Negro, however wealthy, however famous, to be anything at this period of our history at some point than an American Negro. If he doesn't know it, he'll find it out.
From a racial standpoint, yeah, Mr. Robeson, yeah. But from the political standpoint of socialism, which you were discussing a few moments ago, surely a Negro capitalist, if he had the opportunity, would undoubtedly behave according to the lights of his own.
I know many of the most wealthy, and often I feel that they don't help as much as they should. But he's forever conscious his children suffer the same things as the poor Negro's children. And at some point, he finds a way to help. Mm-hmm. It's a little different even there. But that is,
In other words, you feel it tracks through in a different way.
I'm really not, what I'm trying to say is that somewhere for our own dignity, I see, that is Africa, would you understand, Ghana today, unifying as a, with its own sort of, you know, nationalist strength. Is that clear?
Yes. Yeah.
I feel in America, strange to say, especially in the South, that even with all the goodwill of white liberals in the country, that it's very important for the Negro people to know what they want and to unify to do it. Often in a very simple case of fighting segregation, one group of Negroes can be drawn aside because of political pressure, other pressures. We should unify too. We should unify.
Yes,
I feel there's got to be a unity in order to integrate. That's what I feel. I feel that we just can't integrate as individuals.
Yes, but isn't the example of Liberia, for example, a sorry example as it's set against Ghana?
Well, yes, because that's a very simple. The Firestone has taken care of that. It has been exploited to its hilt by Firestone rubber, if you don't know the facts.
Yes, right. It still remains an economic
and
question.
And so has Ghana.
Rather than a racial unity question.
What's that?
It remains an economic question in its fundamentals rather than the unity of the Negro people.
Ghana has the unity of its own nation, same as Chinese or Indians, very close to India. India's just, they have a culture and a history that has its own national characteristics.
But what will prevent Ghana from becoming another Liberia?
That's the...
What do you mean?
Well, from because
Liberia
of the
today
pressures.
Is completely controlled by Firestone, not by Africans. But I feel that Nkrumah is going to control the economy of Ghana, and at some time be strong enough to say to the European, either you sit here and acknowledge that we run our own country, like Nehru, or else you go. But I don't see the day when Liberia can tell Firestone to do that. Oh, they're quite different. They're quite different. Liberia is a complete vassal state of American capital, finance capital, without question. They have nothing to say, nothing whatsoever.
What is your reaction to the passive resistance as practiced in Montgomery?
I think there was a magnificent movement, and nobody can, I say, there's nothing, as far as the general thing of a nonviolent solution of the problem, this is the, there could be no other solution within our, within the frame of things today. I mean, this is a very important, contribution. Nobody could think of a violent solution unless somebody wanted to ask somebody to be destroyed. I mean, that would be absurd. On the other hand, within that framework, I think that the Negro people have to be extremely militant and demand a little more than they are demanding today, and to do a little more, not to do other things as well as pray.
Do you think there's been a change in the attitude of the Negro churches toward militant political and economic action, Mr. Rhodes?
I think there has, because it's history, you know. Take Frederick Douglass. I belong to the AME Zion Church. There is one in this area. And Douglass was a part of that church. Harriet Tubman, who formed the Underground Railroad, who was called the Moses of our people. They sang Go Down Moses when she came into the South to free the slaves. And Harriet Tubman. And we have a tradition of tremendous... consistent speaking out, you know, for our rights, like in the whole civil rights struggle. I mean by militant, letting people know that you want to be free like anybody else. And I think the churches, however, a lot of the responsibility still rests upon our churches, because that's where so many of our people, go. Mm-hmm. They have tremendous influence still.
Mr. Robeson, do you think your artistry as a singer and actor have suffered because of your involvement in political action, or profited?
They have not. I feel that they have profited. They've only suffered when they've suffered by the fact that because of my political views, which I certainly did not expect in a democracy, that I've been prevented from exercising my craft. However, I've kept singing all through the years. You may be able to test it pretty soon. I just made a recording the other day for Vanguard, which they felt was superior to any records I have ever made. My voice is still in fine shape. I've been in the area. And as far as Othello, I've worked on it. I feel I've just been invited to play at Stratford-on-Avon, the Shakespeare Memorial Theatre in England, in, strange to say, in Pericles, to play the part of Gower. And I would certainly do Othello at some point in London, and I feel I would give a better performance. I feel that in every, and I've got a lot of things here which we won't be able to get to in my music, comparing the folk music of the world, I would say that my interest in my art has deepened just no end in the last years, and I've become interested in the music of Bartok, of Mussorgsky, many folk things, the unity of the folk music of the world, which has sprung from my political conviction that all people should be unified. I have seen it expressed in their music, and I do a program, which of all the songs of all the peoples in the world, suggesting that we are all one human family. It all comes to that. So I feel that basically that it has deepened my. On the other hand, I have never separated my work as an artist from my work as a human being. I've always put it even more strongly that, to me, my art is always a weapon. It's got to be good art. Othello was a weapon in racial relations, or at least showing that we can do some things too. I played football. My father explained to me that, well, a fella hit me, I couldn't hit him back because they'd say we were bad and savage. So I had to stand and be knocked all around. I had to do well in my studies. So I've never been able to divorce one thing from the other. And luckily, I don't sing the kind of songs that you're here and you hit the high, whatever it is, the high B flat and the high this and the high that. I sing songs that express very much the emotions of different peoples, like the Welsh, the Scotch, the Negro, Chinese, Russian, and so forth.
Well, what is the present state of play on this passport business? You were talking about your British invitations.
Yes.
How are you going to get there?
Well, luckily, I think at this point, the basic case is before the Supreme Court. It's the case of Rockwell Kent, contending that all the cases revolve around, that when the State Department put in its administrative necessities that one sign a non-communist affidavit, whether or not he is, was, or so forth, that this is a violation of constitutional rights. Any American now has to sign this particular proposal. And this is before the Supreme Court. And in its present temper, it seems to me that the court might easily decide.
And this is what you refuse to do. You refuse to sign such a document.
Oh, yeah, completely refuse. This is a complete invitation. Did you murder your wife yesterday or the day before? Are you a Republican? Are you a Democrat? This is but my political opinions are my own business, This is a complete, and I say we have the background of the reversal in the Smith Act cases all over this country. So somebody was framed, I would say. So it shows that all of it, to my mind, is a complete hoax from somewhere.
In other words, you're hoping that on the basis of some of the current court decisions that you may get your passport in time to go
yes,
to
Yes, or I have now been invited to sing on April 6th in a national television broadcast. Maybe I could get special permission to go. I mean, and because of my background in England, there is almost a national, almost demand from England or request that I be allowed to come in April and even before the summer. And also, I take some optimistic point of view from the fact that where no passports are needed, after restricting me for many years, even in that area, this had to be lifted because the courts would certainly, I think, have ruled that this was completely illegal once I was stopped from going to Hawaii or Puerto Rico, which are parts of the United States. So I can now go anywhere in this hemisphere
Oh, you're not dangerous as long as you stick to the Western Hemisphere.
I'm just saying, if a court is looking at this, how can the State Department argue that if I leave the country, this is extremely dangerous, the guy, he got up in court, the fellow, and if I left, it was going to be a catastrophe. I don't know what would happen the next morning, immediately I get on the plane. But I can now be in Brazil, I can be in the West Indies, I can be in Canada, I can be anywhere in this hemisphere. Why can't I be in London? It doesn't make any sense to me. So I'm optimistic that I may get my passport.
Mr. Rosen, however, if we may change
yes,
the
I'd like to
direction,
get to my concert.
could I, however, ask you some questions along another line for a moment? I have three small children of my own, and I'm very much interested in the problems of children with relation to these larger problems of a man standing up for certain things. Have your children moved around the world with you? In the course of your travels?
Well, I just have one boy.
Oh, you just have one boy.
Just one boy. And he, as you know, traveled around from the time he was about two, traveled with me everywhere, and lived in England, and went to school for a part of his youth in the Soviet Union, speaks Russian very well. And he is now in this country, went to Cornell, and he has two beautiful grandchildren. And he is very happy. His was a mixed marriage in one sense. He married a very wonderful Jewish girl of a Romanian Jewish background, and they're extremely happy. Have two
this
children.
This is concentrating all the problems.
All the problems. And they are very happy and get along very well in Harlem, where they live in the Negro community. And they are both, may I say, to use a much abused term, progressive young Americans. and he's an electronics engineer. And a very fine acoustical engineer. We've done some work together. And she teaches in school, teaches children. There are two children in school, so she teaches in young children's school. And they're very happy. And my wife is an accredited correspondent at the United Nations and does a lot of work for different publications throughout the world. So we keep pretty busy. And but I am very happy to get to the core, be back at my singing, and to say that however I have talk this afternoon that I have great faith. I wouldn't be here if I did not have great faith in that somewhere we will realize the democratic potentials of our life, of our society. I deeply believe that. I fight for peace. I feel we've got to live with many other kinds of systems and other beliefs in the world. We've been able to do it through many generations and centuries. That's the reason why we couldn't find peace in that destruction. And a little faster in understanding the problems of oppressed peoples, wherever they may be. But very happy to be back in the area to sing. In fact, I've come back here, you know, sung in the Negro churches at the Third Baptist in San Francisco, and I sang in Oakland, and I sang in Sacramento and Stockton, and I've been back at my career now for quite some time, mainly in the Negro churches.
Has this been a change? I was not aware that you had been singing in the Negro churches up until recently.
Yes. I wasn't able to sing anywhere else. I wasn't able to get the auditoriums. On the other hand, we have a great tradition in Negro life. All of us, Marian Anderson, Hayes, we all began in Negro churches, and my brother is pastor of a very large church in New York. And every Sunday afternoon, you may go there and hear any of the top Negro artists in the whole concert field, Warfield, anybody. We always go back to the churches. And so it's been a very fine way to walk into a church full of about 2,000 people and say, well, Paul's here this morning, and it's just to see how he sounds. It comes out very well, why fine? But I really have begun and been practicing, and my whole, I mean, have come back into the swing of things in this area. And I want to say that I go so far as to say in this period, some people have said no, but I have found the Pacific Coast, especially the Bay Area, vastly different. I found it very different in feeling from some other sections of the United States. Other people have felt this. Many outside people who have come here to United Nations gatherings feel that you are a little more non-hysterical, that you have a little evidently deeper belief in our democratic faith. And I have felt that. I felt that. So much so that I may even come out to sit around for quite a while out here.
Well, we think it's a wonderful city.
Where may we hear you sing in the near future?
Well, you're going to hear me, I hope, on Sunday afternoon, February 9th, at the Oakland Auditorium Theater. It'd be very important. It's the first time I've had a public auditorium in the area for quite some time. It's sponsored by a committee, a Negro Life, and honoring Negro History Week, which, you know, has been honored now for some time, and Mr. William Duncan Allen, a very gifted pianist who was accompanying me and who is chairman of the Bach Festival in the Berkeley area, is playing some compositions of leading Negro composers. It's an afternoon of music and poetry. I'm reciting some Shakespeare and some Negro and poetry from Negro poets. And singing, as I say, music that ranges through all the folk music of the world. And those composers, like Bartok and Mussorgsky and Dvorak, who have used the folk idiom in their extended and more complex works.
It sounds as if it will be a delightful afternoon.
Well, I hope so.
And we are very grateful to you for coming along to KPFA.
I'm grateful
to
you.
Good job, Mr. Robson.
Thank you, Mr. Robson.
That their sons might be free, have suffered and perished for thee. Wales, Wales, land of mist and wild, where'er I roam, though far Snowden, in brave days of yore, for thee fought for freedom by Mona's green shore. Their courage undaunted inspires all our lays. Our harps e'er resound to their praise. Wales, Wales, land of mist and wild, where'er I roam, though far from my home, the mother is calling her child.
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU, that was Paul Robeson singing the Welsh song, Land of My Fathers. And we had his interview, which he did in February 8th in 1958, in KPFA interview, KPFA radio in Oakland, California. And but just once again, like showing the international solidarity which he had. And he did talk about his relationship with the Soviet Union a little bit in that interview. Remember, this is at the height of the Cold War, heart of McCarthyism, and he's still openly talking about this. He's proud of it. And so I want to devote the last part of the show here more to Paul Robeson and his relationship with the USSR. So this is a talk which was given by the Communist Party of Great Britain, Marxist-Leninist, a few years ago about Paul Robeson and the USSR. So I'm going to close on that. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
Hi, Collins. I was asked to speak about Paul Robeson and Paul Robeson's opinion of Stalin and his opinion of the Soviet Union, which are two things which are very much intertwined. I first learnt about Paul Robeson on the 100th anniversary of his birth, which was now 15 years ago in 1998. I hadn't known about him at all before then, because he's a figure who's very much really written out of history. You don't hear his songs played widely, even though they occupy quite a historic and pivotal role in the development of film industry and recording industry. So some beautiful songs. He was the first person who notably started recording Negro spirituals and popularizing them, and at the time was a vastly popular performer. There are many things about him and his life which actually parallel Stalin's in quite a remarkable way if you look at them. Paul Robeson was born in Princeton. Stalin wasn't born in Princeton, obviously. Paul Robeson was born in Princeton. His father had been a slave in North Carolina. His father had been obviously a proud man who was born to slavery, who never accepted the dogma that would have been prevalent and hard to overlook, that blacks were in some way inferior growing up in that system. And he escaped on the Underground Railroad north, and he came to live in Princeton. It must be the case that he would have come into contact with people such as Harriet Tubman, who famously conducted the Underground Railroad, and who famously said, "I will have one of two things. I will have my liberty or my death. You know, let no man put their hand upon me. I won't sacrifice my freedom." And still, those, I think, are very inspiring words and sentiments of the oppressed everywhere when they're struggling for their freedom. I'm sure that he would have played, I recently wrote an article on the American Civil War, I'm sure he must have played some role, his father, in the American Civil War. Interesting to note, again, not widely known, that 25% of the Union Navy, which was integrated, were blacks, and some 10% of the Union Army were black, and they played a really decisive role in the victory of the Americans. So Afro-Americans, despite being initially an enslaved people, a people of an internal colony, if you like, in the United States, especially in the South of the United States, played a pivotal role in the development of the modern nation and won their place, won their freedom, despite suffering many reverses after the restoration, of their socially inferior position. There was the abolition of slavery. Not widely known and appreciated that Stalin himself, his father, had been a serf. So essentially, he also came from the stock of a people who had just recently liberated from a semi-slavery position, not free to move from the land, inferior in social status, and from an inferior nation within a large empire of Tsarism. So that there was that parallel. Stalin, of course, joining the revolutionary movement. And really, you know, from a young age, he was a talented guy whose mother saw the chance to educate him and make something of his life and wanted him to go into the seminary. So he went into the seminary at Tivoli, got an education, came into contact with Marxist literature and never really looked back, was thrown out of the seminary, gained a really excellent knowledge through his own personal hard study of Marxism, threw himself into the revolutionary movement, and ultimately, we know, came to play a pivotal role in the successful victory of that revolutionary movement, coming to lead the mother nation and all of the lesser nations. And in coming from an inferior nation, so-called, from a colonized nation, he understood the pivotal importance of correcting the relations between so-called superior and inferior nationalities, the colonized and the colonizers, in order to foster a great unity and create a great force of the working and oppressed masses that was capable of working towards liberation. And that's something that had a very deep resonance with Robeson when he saw it. Robeson grew in a place where Jim Crow and segregation was the norm, where blacks still occupied an inferior race despite their history in the Civil War. He was a very intelligent kid, who did well at school, got a scholarship to go to university, went to Tuskegee University. While he was there, it was a hulk of a man who was talented in many respects, and he went to play American football there. The team, who were all the rest of them were white, they were hardly any black people at university, set upon him, basically tortured him, broke his collarbone, pulled his nails out of his hand, to let him know that black people weren't welcome in the football team. And his father raised him to say that we're equal in every way, and we have to take everything we get, we have to overcome those odds, and we have to show that we're capable of struggle and changing the world. He was a passionate believer that the heights of knowledge had to be scaled by the freedom seeker. So there was no area of knowledge that could be barred to them, but equally had to show a gritty and steely determination to assert their right to that knowledge and a right to their place in the sun and a right to abolish that system of discrimination. So he overcame that. He went on to become an All-American football player, something which in itself is a sporting accolade. He was the valedictorian of his class, meaning he read the kind of speech saying farewell to the class, which is a big thing in the States. This remains a big thing for them. And then he went on to study law, but found that, there was segregation. He couldn't really pursue a career in the law, so he turned to his other interests in arts, became a fantastic singer, legitimized, if you like, the heritage of the slaves, which was their music, if you like, their spirit of resistance, the Negro spiritual, made it a kind of an accepted part of the American cultural scene, became famous in acting and on the stage. But at that time, he found the atmosphere more liberal in Europe, and he actually left the United States to come to Europe. And it was during his time in Europe that he really came into contact with the working class movement. And he found that despite the fact that he was black and relatively privileged, at that time, in the late 20s and early 30s, he had a tremendous sympathy with the rising working class movement. This was a time when there would have been the old CPGB that everyone among us can agree was a revolutionary party. And he came into contact with white working class people and felt he had a tremendous commonality of interests with them in fighting oppression. And when he went to Wales in particular and heard their singing and they heard his singing, they took him into their hearts, really. And explained to him that although he was privileged, he was from basically an oppressed people, as they were oppressed working people, and as far as they were concerned, they were the same people. He had a very moving relationship with them, and it was under their influence that he first went to he went to Spain, actually, and he sung in Spain in the international brigades. He didn't go there till 1938, so right before the fall of the Republic, but he sang there in many tongues, and there are many songs, and was very close to the people of Spain, Republican Spain. And he never really looked back from his association with the Soviet Union and their ideas. And I'm going to read a little . So this is what Robeson said in his own words in Here I Stand. He said, "There I saw that it was the working men and women of Spain who were heroically giving their last full measure of devotion to the cause of democracy in that bloody conflict, and that it was the upper class, the landed gentry, the bankers and industrialists, who had unleashed the fascist beast against their own people. From the ranks of the workers of other lands, volunteers had come to help in the epic defense of Madrid. And in Spain, I sang with my whole heart and soul for these gallant fighters of the International Brigade. A new warm feeling for my homeland grew within me as I met the men of the Abraham Lincoln Battalion, the thousands of brave young Americans who had crossed the sea to fight and die as another government of the people, by the people, and for the people shall not perish from the earth. My heart was filled with admiration and love for these white Americans, and there was a sense of great pride in my own people when I saw that there were Negroes too in the ranks of the Lincoln men in Spain. Some of them, like Oliver Laws and Milton Herndon, were to be among the heavy casualties suffered by the volunteers and would be buried along with their white comrades in the Spanish earth, a long way from home. From home, yes, from America, my own home. And I knew in my own heart that I'd surely return there someday." I think it's so important at this time. I was speaking to a friend of mine about our party, the CPGBML, and the Stalin Society to an extent, and he was saying, it's fine, but it's like a Soviet history society, and I wonder if it really has any ongoing relevance to today. And, you know, what's your strategy for really effecting a change in this country? And I think it's something we have to always consider in all our activities. And my fundamental answer is that, yes, society is organised in a very poor manner to satisfy the interests of the vast majority of human beings. And I don't think at any time on the face of the earth a greater civilization or more steps to correct that situation have been taken under the leadership of the old Soviet leaders, and that they really blazed a trail which remains absolutely pertinent and relevant to us today. And so then the question always to me is, how do we build that movement here? I think we have the material in England to build such a movement. I think it's in the interests of the vast majority of people to build such a movement. And so the question is, how do you take the transition from being, if you like, a despised and reviled and victimised member of the working class, essentially oppressed, even an imperialist nation, and cross over to the point where you have the confidence to assert your right to change society, that you have a pattern that you see, think it's feasible, and you start to gather people together to do it. And a very important part of that is to break the media monopoly that constantly tells them that it's not possible. If it's in the interest and a perfectly sane and rational thing for imperialism every day to declare that Stalin was a monster and, you know, and Soviet Union, you know, is dead and Marxism is dead and there's no way forward for working people, it's absolutely our duty to reassert that actually it is possible. We have a glorious and rich culture and heritage, and it's precisely by ploughing this furrow that we can actually begin to make that change. And it's very instructive to see how people coming from the belly of the beast, from imperialist countries, can and were inspired by the example of the Soviet Union. I'm going to finish in a little while by reading Robeson's own assessment of Stalin and the role that he made. But I think Robeson's life itself, coming from an oppressed people, throughout his twists and turns in his career, of seeing the living, breathing example of the Soviet Union, what it meant in real practical terms, especially to colonised and oppressed people, and his approach of one of real internationalism, of never falling for what is again becoming popular, of a kind of a black separatist or a national separatist or a minority position. He absolutely overwhelmingly saw, from the example of the Soviet Union, it's possible to solve national differences, racial differences, religious differences, the contradiction between men and women, the contradiction between old and young, between town and country, and actually build a tremendous unity and a force for change. And really, that is the message I think we need to take from the Soviet Union, from Stalin, and bring it, you know, into a modern context in our work and our daily bearing. During the war, during the Second World War, Robeson had a relatively easy time. Obviously, we know there were lots of uncharacteristic features of American imperialism that came out during that time. Because of their temporary alliance with the Soviet Union, they had a temporary truce from their propaganda, and even made, you know, programs and published books showing how great the Soviet people were, how great Stalin's leadership was, that he was on the cover of Time magazine as their man of the year for 2 years, and all the rest of it. So he had a relatively easy time during the war, but after the war, the propaganda against Robeson was well and truly stepped up, and he found himself increasingly pushed to the side. He actually visited the Soviet Union again in 1949, and while he was there, he commented. Actually, on the way back, he went to the Paris Peace Conference, and there he was encouraged by reporters to denounce the Soviet Union. He said, I think the specific question was, if there was going to be a war, because the Cold War kind of atmosphere was really settling hard then, if there's going to be a Soviet war, if there's going to be a war between America and the Soviet Union, you know, whose side would you encourage, you know, black Americans to fight on? And he basically said, it is unthinkable that American Negroes could go to war on behalf of those who have oppressed them for generations against the Soviet Union, which in one generation has raised our people to full human dignity. I think it's important to note that while he was in Britain during the 20s and 30s, he actually studied at SOAS and started to uncover there a real untold story of the towering civilization of Africa, which to him stood alongside the civilization of Europe and the civilization of Asia. And actually, at that time, he tells a funny story. He says, you know, as he was starting to propagate this information, really, a kind of self-improvement, a kind of early black power, not black power, but to say, look, there's no way that you can be held down as subhuman, as lesser people. You have a rich culture and heritage which has simply been written out of history because it's expedient for colonialism to do so. And he said at that time he was propagating that information. He said it was important, he felt, for the blacks themselves within America, England and elsewhere to know it. Because at that time he came into contact with a lot of people who were studying from Africa and the colonies in England who were building a national liberation movement. And he said the British intelligence came one day to caution me about the political meaning of my activities. For the question loomed large of itself. If African culture was what I said it was, what happens to the British imperialist's claim that it would take 1,000 years for Africans to be capable of self-rule? So their real material interests were threatened by this seemingly abstract and, you know, esoteric academic pursuit. And it was at that time that he was told he should go to the Soviet Union, because one of his friends had told him about Africa, something he had observed in the Soviet Union. He said on a visit to that country, he'd travelled east and he'd seen the Yakuts, a people who had been classed as a backward race by the Tsars, and he'd been struck by the resemblance between the tribal life of the Yakuts and his own people of East Africa. What would happen to their Yakuts now that they had been freed from colonial oppression and were part of the construction of a socialist society? Well, I went to see for myself, and on my first visit to the Soviet Union in 1934, I saw how the Yakuts and Uzbeks and all the other formerly oppressed nations were leaping ahead from tribalism to modern industrial economy, from illiteracy towards the heights of knowledge, their ancient cultures blooming in new and greater richness, their young men and women mastering the sciences and arts. 1,000 years, no, less than 20. But after the war, as I say, the climate was radically changed. And particularly after his intervention, after the Paris Peace Conference, he found that he was barred from appearing in movies, barred from the stage. He'd been a very great Shakespearean actress, amongst other things, and famously was one of the first black men who played Othello to a white audience in the South. Theatre-growing audience was overwhelmingly white in America. So it had many, many artistic and academic accolades and strings to his bow. But he went on, nevertheless, to be unbowed. The NAACP, who were the leadership, you know, the National Association of African-American and Coloured Peoples, were of a much more bourgeois leaning and simply wanted to, if you like, get rid of some of the discrimination towards the black bourgeoisie within America, allow them to develop, but not get rid of the edifice of exploitation, not really have a revolutionary leaning on the struggle, but nevertheless had a role to play, obviously, as we're familiar historically, in the civil rights movement, what's referred to as the civil rights movement. Although Robeson really was one of the forefathers of the civil rights movement, together with people like W.B. Du Bois. But then the NAACP disowned him. They found this all a bit distasteful. They thought this was bringing, you know, all this anti-communist rhetoric to bear on black people within America. People would see them as a disloyal part of society, and they were disowned. And Robeson pointed out that, you know, they didn't have that calm in 1944 when they gave him the Spingarn Medal in services of freedom to all men. And he went on to assert the tremendous strides, in fact he said in his acceptance speech at the time, that the tremendous strides of the various peoples of the Soviet Union have given the greatest proof of the latent abilities, not only of so-called agricultural peoples, presumably unfitted for intricate industrial technique, but also of so-called backward peoples who have clearly demonstrated that they function like all others. He went on to say that even in the worst period of McCarthyism, he saw no reason why my convictions should change with the weather. I was not raised that way, and neither the promise of gain nor the threat of loss has ever moved me from my firm convictions. I think it's worth just very briefly saying that he was called to testify before the House Committee on American Affairs in 1956, and one of his last of interventions, public interventions in American life. And it was, I mean, people were being called up from all walks of life and asked to disavow, asked whether they were members of the Communist Party, asked to publicly disavow, you know, being associated with the Communist movement and the Communist Party. It's not clear to this day, really, whether Robeson was a member or wasn't a member of the Communist Party. I don't think it's really the point. It's clear he was a, it was clear he was a great believer and sympathiser in scientific socialism, great friend of the Soviet Union, Soviet people, and saw the way towards liberation of all people down that line, and wanted to do everything in his power to encourage and promote the movement. But when he was called up to testify in 57, he angered the senators by telling them, "In Russia, I felt for the first time like a full human being. No colour prejudice like in Mississippi, no colour prejudice like in Washington." The senators angrily demanded, "Why didn't you stay in Russia then, if you love it so much?" And he retorted quick as a flash, "Because my father was a slave, and my people died to build this country, and I'm going to stay right here and have a piece of it, just like you." "And no fascist-minded people will drive me from it. Is that clear?" He was made of steely stuff. He said, "History shows that the process of social change has nothing in common with silly notions of plots and conspiracies. The development of human society from tribalism to feudalism to capitalism to socialism is brought about by the needs and aspirations of mankind for a better life." I mean, it's clear from all that he said and did in his life that he was a true Marxist, a true friend of the Soviet Union, a champion of real internationalism, a champion of integrationist approach to building unity amongst the working class. And for all those things, I salute him. For all those things, he saluted the Soviet Union and Stalin. And I think it's maybe fitting just to end, there's much more I could say, but to end with his tribute to Stalin, which is only, it's brief really, it's a couple of A4 pages. I hope you'll bear with me. I'm just going to basically read it to you. There's no way I can augment or embellish it. It's very beautiful. I think once you're familiar with Robeson, there's no question as to its authenticity. I only bring that up because there are people who doubt it. I mean, it was 15 years ago, I think I made a presentation which was exclusively on Robeson at that time to the Stalin Society. It was on my birthday, I don't know, 15 years ago. And after I'd learnt about him, because you know it was a topic that was coming up 100 years after his birth in lots of spheres. The SWP held that, as they do, their Marxism 1998, it was then, and they had a big session on Robeson, and they brought people up to talk about Robeson's contribution, and they talked about some of these, you know, major cultural achievements of his. They gave a brief portrait of his life. What they really wanted to get to the bottom of was how that Robeson, when he went back to the Soviet Union the second time, spent most of his time disgusted at the national oppression of the Jews and was singing songs of protest about them. And I mean, it's their own line which they're attributing to Robeson, and there's no objective evidence to say that. But I wrote at the end of an article I wrote at the time, and I think it kind of answers the point as well as any. What would that say? You know, with such slanders, like they were trying to undermine Robeson's support of the Soviet Union, dissociate what was obviously a great and popular figure from the Soviet Union, which they've made it their business, if you like, their stock in trade to slander. But where does that leave Robeson? Because if their allegations are true, and he didn't raise his voice in open protest, having allegedly witnessed some kind of national oppression of the Jews, what's left of Robeson's integrity? Why did he suffer such privation when denouncing the Soviet Union would have had a stroke, you know, restored his career to its former glory, if it was not, as he consistently maintained, in fact free from all national, racial and religious prejudice, to the point that, having said that it was the first place where he walked fully upright as a human being, he sent his own son to be educated there. We tell stories of, yeah, there was a little bit, it was asked, wasn't there racism in Russia? Well, there's a very small amount of residual racism. One boy once called him a racist name in class. The other members of the class rounded on that boy and made him so thoroughly ashamed of himself and ostracized that Paul Robeson's son, Paul Jr., ended up feeling sorry for the guy who had taunted him with racist abuse. That was the spirit at that time when he went there. Now we can see that with the destruction of the Soviet Union, with the reintroduction of national strife, with the reintroduction of capitalism, how there's a resurgent fascist movement, how even, sadly, because the communists were the ones who actually made the Soviet Union great, and Stalin was such a great leader, there's even a faction of the fascist movement which looks up to Stalin as the great national leader and founder. So there's all kinds of resurgence of right-wing propaganda there, and no doubt racism there now. We know that there is. And you have to look at football matches in Ukraine to see that that is the case. But that was certainly not the atmosphere at the time when people were moving forward and building. And what Paul Robeson saw and witnessed then remains one of the greatest testimonies to the way in which a prison of nations can be turned into a brotherhood of nations. And without that experience, without that movement, without that goal, there's no way forward for us in really reshaping and remodeling human history. So I'm gonna go back to what Robeson said. I say, really, having studied the man and seen him, you can see from the words that they're Robeson's own words. They're unforced, unstinted, and they give a generous and full appraisal of Stalin's worth, which I think is timely to remind ourselves now after 60 years of Stalin's death. And so I'll let Robeson say the rest. It's called To You, Beloved Comrade, by Paul Robeson. He says, there is no richer store of human experience than the folk tales, folk poems and songs of a people. In many, the heroes are always fully recognisable humans, only larger and more embracing in dimension. And so it is with the Russian, Chinese and African folklore. In 1937, a highly expectant audience of Moscow citizens, workers, artists, youth, farmers from surrounding towns crowded the Bolshoi Theatre. They awaited a performance by the Uzbek National Theatre, headed by the highly gifted Tamara Khanum. The orchestra was a large one, with instruments ancient and modern. How exciting would be the blending of the music of the rich culture of Mussorgsky, Tchaikovsky, Prokofiev, Shostakovich, Krennikov, Glier, with that of the beautiful music of the Uzbeks, stemming from an old and proud civilization. Suddenly everyone stood, began to applaud, to cheer, and to smile. The children waved. In a box to the right, smiling and applauding at the audience, as well as the artists on stage, stood the great Stalin. I remember the tears began to quietly flow, and I too smiled and waved. Here was clearly a man who seemed to embrace all. So kindly, I can never forget the warm feeling of kindliness and also a feeling of sureness. Here was one who was wise and good. The world, and especially the socialist world, was fortunate indeed to have his daily guidance. I lifted high my son Paulie to wave to this world leader and his leader, for Paulie Jr. had entered school in Moscow, in the land of the Soviets. The wonderful performance began, unfolding new delights at every turn, ensemble and individual, vocal and orchestral, classic and folk dancing of amazing originality. Could it be possible that a few years before, in 1900, in 1915, these people had been semi-serfs, their cultural expression forbidden, their rich heritage almost lost on desirous oppression's heel. So here one witnessed in the field of the arts a culture national in form, socialist in content. Here was a people quite comparable to some of the tribal folk of Asia, quite comparable to the proud Yoruba or Basutu of West and East Africa. But now their lives flowering anew, within the socialist way of life, 20 years matured under the guidance of Lenin and Stalin. And in this whole area of development of national minorities, of their relation to the great Russians, Stalin had played and was playing a most decisive role. I was later to travel to see with my own eyes what could happen to the so-called backward peoples. In the West, in England, in Belgium, France, Portugal, Holland, the Africans, the Indians, East and West, many of the Asian peoples were considered so backward that centuries, perhaps, would have to pass before these so-called colonials could become a part of modern society. But in the Soviet Union, Yakuts, Donetsis, Kyrgyz, Tajiks had respect and were helped to advance with unbelievable rapidity in this socialist land. No empty promises, such as coloured folk continuously here in the United States, but deeds. For example, the transforming of the desert in Uzbekistan into blooming acres of cotton. And an old friend of mine, Mr. Golden, trained under Carver at Tuskegee, played a prominent role in cotton production. In 1949, I saw his daughter, now grown in the university, a proud Soviet citizen. Today, in Korea Today, of course, he's speaking on the death of Stalin in 53. Today in Korea, in Southeast Asia, in Latin America and the West Indies, in the Middle East, in Africa, one sees tens of millions of long-oppressed colonial peoples surging towards freedom. What a difference in the national and international atmosphere there is between